Welcome to the Habit Podcast, conversations with writers about writing. I'm Jonathan Rogers, your host. Andrew Peterson is a songwriter and a novelist. I don't know how a person excels at both, but he does. He's also the founder of the Rabbit Room. A great gatherer of people, Andrew lives out that Rabbit Room motto, art nourishes community and community nourishes art. He's hugely talented, but more importantly, he knows what to do with his talents. More than anybody else I know, Andrew Peterson understands that his gifts aren't just gifts for him, but for the wider world. He's one of my best friends, and nobody has had a greater impact on my work and creative life. Andrew Peterson, thank you so much for being on the Habit Podcast. I'm so glad you're here. I've read Adorning the Dark. As of this recording, I've read it twice because I don't even know what to say about why and how much I love this book. But one thing I love about it, though, is I've gone through it with a group of people in the Habit Membership Book Club. And the level of conversation that it's generated from them, and also just the fact that they, in writing this book, I think you're giving people the language to talk about what's going on in the book. I think that's what's, and it, well, I say you're giving them the language in the book. I think a lot of the fact that people that I'm reading it with are so know what to do with it, I think is a testament to kind of what's been going on in your work your whole career. I mean, and in the Rabbit Room and in your own songwriting and in your novels, you've been giving people some language to think about their own creative life, which I think I don't know if you the extent to which you were setting out to do that, but I think you have.
Well, thank you. That's good to hear. And I don't know that I was that. I don't know that that crossed my mind as a thing. I was mainly wanting to give like. Encourage people in the sense of give them courage.
Yeah.
And so I have found over the years that one of the best ways to encourage people is commiseration.
Yeah.
And so feeling like you're alone is, you know, goes against what we were made for at our core. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, the art can do a lot of different things, but the songs that have moved me the most, not just the songs, but the kind of in general, the art that's moved me the most has been the kind of art that said, hey, either you're not as crazy as you think you are, or you're crazy, but you're not the only one.
Uh-huh.
And that just like the sigh of relief that produces in me is huge. And I don't know I don't know if that's just some people or if it's everybody, but I thought, well, if I could write a book that is helpful in that way, then at least some people will be encouraged by it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good to hear. I'm
glad. Do you still feel lonely in making stuff?
It just depends on what I have for breakfast. You know,
yeah.
I don't know. There are days when I do, and you know, I have practiced. You know, there's a spiritual formation aspect of the writing life. Like you develop things that are like spiritually shaping,
mm-hmm.
and so. Things like I don't always do it, but I know that when it's time to make a record, I walk through my days in a different way than when I'm not making a record. Like I feel like I've just like turned the knob up on my practice of paying attention to the world around me and the mm-hmm. people around me, and asking myself if it's true that heaven and earth are full of God's glory, then where is that? Where mm-hmm. where do I see that, and how do I? It's not, you know, and it's not as simple as just going, oh, that's a pretty thing, but like finding something to say about that pretty thing that hopefully is unique enough, or you're coming at it from a different enough angle, or an angle that is you enough that could maybe trip somebody up, you know, if they're kind of zombie walking through
yeah,
the
right.
world, you can put a little stick in the path that says, hey. There's another way to do this.
Yeah.
And so all that to say that like there is a like a spiritual form, and I've been thinking about this after Carolyn Ahrens' talk at Hutchmoot
mm-hmm. yeah.
about spiritual formation, and I'm not like I don't know how to talk about that very well yet, but they but yeah, I was just thinking like, oh, if you spend 25 years trying to figure out how to write a song, then the songs are one byproduct. But then the better thing is the fact that you as a human have been practicing paying attention to the world around you, you know?
Yeah.
And so in that sense, I think that I'm not less susceptible to feeling alone, but I recognize the traps now. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And in the book, I talk about the building the dry stack wall. Like there was a, I just built another one outside outside the chapter house.
You are just going to be a series of walls.
I just built another one, and you start the project, and I realize I had a little bit of window of time to work on it, and that, you know, it's beginning the project means it's time to go get some rocks, you know, mm-hmm. and I have to take a serious deep breath and enter a different mode of thinking when it's time to build a wall, because I know all the work that it takes just to get to the part where you're stacking rocks on top of rocks, you know
yeah.
what I mean? And so, which is so much like songwriting. I was just kind of like, oh, when it's time to make a record, you just think, how do you even start doing this? Well, you just start, you just mm-hmm. do stuff. And,
yeah.
And it takes work to get to the fun part.
Yeah.
You know? And so all that to say that like in that sense, when I started building the stone wall this time, it was like, okay, I recognize this. This is not a reason to not do it. It's just, this is the thing that I've got to do in order to get to the fun part. Mm-hmm. And you know, there was something that I was telling my brother about this the other day, that you get this, sorry, I don't mean to talk about rocks this whole time, but you get this big pile of rocks. It's like, you know, 4 feet tall, you know, that you've carried to near where you're going to work. And it's never as many as you need, but at first you've got this big pile of rocks, and there's a lot of time, like it's like putting a puzzle together, but mm-hmm. but the pieces are not meant to go together. So you're just turning the rocks over and flipping around and trying to find. But after about a week or so, I got to where I could see a slot in the wall about 20 feet away, and I could look at a rock and know with a pretty decent accuracy that's going to fit perfectly in that little slot. And the wow. satisfaction of grabbing that rock and carrying it 20 feet and slipping it right into place is just like nothing else. It's just like and that's true of songwriting too, with words. You go, after a while, there's this struggle, but once you kind of grease the wheel, you get to working and you get into a flow and you're like, oh, I know what word goes in this little slot.
You, when you say what word goes in that slot, that sounds like you're talking about vocabulary. I think you're probably talking about something else, aren't you?
I'm talking about songwriting. Like that's what I'm comparing it to. Is like
sure.
you've got a verse, and you've got, you know, a rhythm that you're singing to, and I've got to find a way to say this thing in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it comes easy. Sometimes you're like, oh, wow. I'm a songwriter. I just wrote a thing, you know, and that's rare, but it's, yeah. you know, you get just enough of those to keep going.
Yeah. I want to return to something you said a while back. You mentioned the idea, you mentioned the idea of, so you look around the world and you see the beauties of the world and you were just, this was off the top of your head, so you may not remember exactly what you said, but you said basically you find something that's uniquely you. I can't remember now. I don't remember how you said it, but basically, it's not just that you're looking. It's not just that you're looking for something nobody's ever noticed before, but you are looking for your own self, your own way of seeing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you have anything more to say about that?
Just that I think that there's a lot of pressure when you're writing a song to try to write a song that nobody's ever written before.
Mm-hmm.
So love songs are the example that pop into my head. That if you It's daunting to write a love song,
yeah.
Because there's a lot of good love songs in the world,
yeah.
But nobody else has been married to your wife as long as you've been married to your wife. Nobody else,
not even close.
Yeah, yeah. So freeing yourself of the need to be to be unique,
yeah.
in that way, and just going and kind of going, I'm just going to write a song for her. Mm-hmm. Specifically for her, then it's a new love song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the feelings, I know I've talked about this in some other episode of this podcast, but the feelings that feel so unique to you, are there's nothing unique about what you feel. But there aren't that many feelings.
Mm-hmm.
But what is unique is, you know, the house you've lived in with Jamie,
mm-hmm.
and you know, the specifics are unique.
Yeah.
The feelings aren't. And so to take the pressure off to write about the feelings and say, I'm just going to write about this house.
Yeah, sure.
Or this, you know, whatever, this trip we took together.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, this is unique all of a sudden.
Yeah, totally.
It's really wild, at a
DNA level, your relationship with your loved one is different than every other relationship ever.
Yeah.
You know? And so, so I guess that's what I mean is you just go, I think sometimes the enemy wants us to shut us up because we, and the trick he uses to say, you have nothing new to say, you're not special, whatever. And, you know, there's a sense in which, well, no, we're not special, but there's nobody else can write this song but you. Where was it? I was watching some TV show the other day and somebody said, they were talking to a counselor and they were like, why am I complaining? This suffering isn't anything special. And the counselor said something like, the deepest suffering is your own. And I remember thinking, oh yeah, that's it. You know,
yeah.
Like, all you have is your experience.
And yeah.
So, that is.
And an idea I keep coming back to was something that Sam Smith said at a talk at Hutchmood a few weeks ago, you can't write like Tolkien, but Tolkien can't write like you either.
Amen. Yeah. Take that, Tolkien.
Yeah, right.
That's good, yeah.
Yeah, and it sounds like some kind of, in one sense, it sounds like some sort of facile, you know, I don't know, you know, self-esteem kind of
sure.
thing or something,
yeah, yeah.
But it's just literally true.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I thought that when I watched Pete's play, The Hiding Place.
Yeah.
And Frankenstein was that way too.
Yeah.
I was like, I can't think of another human being on earth who could have done this in this way.
Yeah.
Than Pete. Like this guy who, with the history that he's had, his like early on love of language and mm-hmm. high prose and all of that stuff,
yeah.
coupled with him, you know, being in the military for a few years and then
yeah.
having this beautiful and rocky journey to faith in Christ, to, you know, being a part of the rabbit room thing, like all of those little ingredients go into the cauldron that mm-hmm. make The Hiding Place exactly what it is in a way that it could not be,
yeah.
couldn't have been written by anybody else.
Yep.
Like it was so delightful when I was watching it. There were moments where I was like, where I saw my brother in the play, you know, where I was like, undeniably, that is my brother talking. And it was this like, you know, deep, like, is it pathos? Is that how you say that word? I'm always intimidated by Greek words, but is that a Greek word?
It is.
Okay. Welcome to my brain. Anyway, but like the depth of emotion that's in it, but then the scene with the Eucharist in the concentration camp, I was like, man, this is just, if my brother hadn't written it, I would have been calling him as soon as I walked out of the theater to say, you would love this play, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that's the thing, is like all of these little ingredients get you to a point, and it takes a long time to find that voice, but mm-hmm. once you tap into it, there's nothing like it.
Yeah. I mean, I love that example because that's a story that's already been told. Pete didn't make up that story.
Right. Yeah.
And it's, you know, millions and millions of people have read that story, and yet here it is again.
Yep. He found a way to tell her story in a way that is uniquely Pete.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yep. And it's Pete's not the only person who can do that.
Right.
I mean, he's the only person who could do that particular thing, but
right.
but everybody brings a sensibility and a different combination of experiences, and mm-hmm. it's a remarkable thing to
yeah.
think about. Yeah. So my favorite passage in this whole book is a little thing you wrote when you were walking. Well, I don't know. You weren't walking when you wrote it. It was about walking from down the hill.
Oh yeah.
And you observe that, I wish I could find it. I've got the book right here, but now I can't find it.
You mean you don't have it memorized? You don't have the page number?
I worked at it for a while, but I'm old. It's the idea, the gist of it is that we're just reassembling the beauty that's around us anyway.
Hmm.
And so, the I just want to talk about that for a little while.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, again, this is also, again, I think we're talking about originality again. And where originality comes from, it doesn't come from looking deep inside necessarily. It comes from looking out and, right. and thinking, the only person who looks out through these eyeballs is me. So if I just write what I see, mm-hmm. that by definition, there's something original there.
Right. Yeah, totally. And I think that, if I'm remembering right, that passage is the one where it talks about how we're like toddlers in a cathedral.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Kind of playing around on the floor in the light of the stained glass or whatever.
Let me read it.
Sure.
I'm convinced that poets are toddlers in a cathedral, slobbering on wooden blocks and piling them up in the light of the stained glass. We could hardly make anything beautiful that wasn't beautiful in the first place. We aren't writers so much as gleeful rearrangers of words whose meanings we can't begin to know. When we manage to make something pretty, it's only because we are ourselves a flourish on a greater canvas. That means there's no end to the discovery. That's good stuff.
Thank you. I like hearing your Southern accent read that.
Great.
It's good. No, really. It makes me happy. I feel smarter listening to Jonathan Rogers read my words.
We can't make anything beautiful that wasn't already beautiful.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what to add to that except to say that it just relieves the pressure a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's not our job to make God's world beautiful. Like, he's already made it beautiful.
Yeah.
We just get to tell about it.
It's our job to give an account of what we've seen.
Yeah.
That's great.
Thank you.
And the relief of not looking inward anymore.
Whew. Huge. Yeah. It's funny. I just did a podcast with Ian Cron, and you know, it was about the Enneagram, so we went dark, you know.
Yeah, right.
Talking about the Enneagram 4 stuff. And anyway, I just talked, or maybe I may be getting confused, but I was mentioned somewhere that I, when I look back at my early songwriting, I can see that kind of like inward looking, like I can send, the listener probably isn't receiving the songs that way, but because I know who I was when I was writing those songs, I feel like I could hear in the songs like a misguided need to be somebody. To kind of like leave my mark on the world somehow. And man, it's just, I just am not interested in that anymore. Mm. And I've been thinking about it a lot lately. There's this Rich Mullins quote that I love. If your ambition is to leave a legacy, then what you'll leave is a legacy of ambition.
That's Rich Mullins?
That's Rich Mullins. Sounds just like Chesterton, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I love that thought because it's kind of like if our goal here is to like, and I think, you know Milton better than I do, but I remember in the beginning of, you know, doesn't he like invite God to like help him tell a story that is going to be this world changing thing? Mm-hmm. Am I getting that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just kind of feel like that's just, it's not right. That's not what our ultimate goal is. There's a sense in which your goal as a writer or an artist, or as just a human doing the thing, like, my goal, like on my best days, what I would want at my funeral is for Christ himself to be the star of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And this just popped into my head, but Stephen Curtis Chapman, I hope it's okay if I talk about this. Like, he has the best reputation, I think, of anybody I've ever met. Like, I lived in Nashville for many years before I met or got to know Stephen, and I was so skeptical. I'm like, everybody's like, he's such a good man. And I remember being like, okay, I can't wait to spend some time on the tour bus with this guy because I'm going to find out if this is really true. And right off the bat, I realized Stephen was broken and, you know, he had his flaws, but there was something about the way he drew attention to Christ's goodness in the middle of it that so that the conversations about Stephen later are about that and not him. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you just get the sense that it's Jesus filling in those blanks, and then what you remember is the glory and not the grime. And so, I don't know, there was just something interesting about that it's not, our goal is not to leave behind a reputation that we were awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not what we're trying to do. And it's not what we should be doing with our songs or anything else. It's like, oh, I'm going to write a song that's going to be a song for the ages, you know? Like, no, that's not the point. Like, if that's the point, then you're going to run out of gas eventually.
Yeah.
And so anyway, it reminds me of Brown Bannister, since we're sitting here in this Lipscomb studio. And I may have told you this story, but when I dropped Aiden off the day when he moved into college here at Lipscomb, I was just a mess. I was crying the whole time and and he was kind of like, Papa, get it together, you know? And the reason I was so grieving was not just that I was going to miss my son, but that I felt I had all this regret. I was like, oh, you know, it's kind of like at the end of Schindler's List with this ring, you know, like every night that I was watching Netflix at home, I could have been spending drawing with my son in his bedroom or, you know, all of this stuff. Just the voices were loud and I was beating myself up over it. And he was like, relax, you're a good dad. And Jamie was like, Andrew, you're a good dad. It's okay. And then we got to the school and everybody that I met, they'd be like, oh, how are you handling all this? And I'm like, man, I just have so many regrets. And they'd say, oh, no, you're a good dad. You're a good dad. And none of it helped until I bumped into Brown. And he's a professor here. And he's like, how you doing? And I was like, man, I'm not doing great. And I gave him the whole thing. I just have so many regrets. And he laughed. And he goes, oh, I remember that feeling. It has been so fun to see how the Lord has made good of my mistakes. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time that anybody said it, it's like turned the narrative around a little bit and said, well, of course you, why would you not have regrets? You're human. You're a mess. You haven't done this right. That's not the point. The point is watch how the Lord redeems the thing. And then he gets the glory. So I guess that's the goal with what you're writing is like, it's not that you try any less hard to be excellent. Mm-hmm. But there's just this little nuanced shift in thinking that I think is where like the gas in the engine comes from.
Yeah. Well, I thought this is where you were headed with that train of thought.
It may have been.
One thing I really love about your book, Adorning the Dark, is I think it's early in the book. You get on the subject of your this need to feel like you are somebody that gets you started writing, that, as you said, can't sustain you. It's okay if that's where you start.
Totally.
And I think that the grace in that I thought was really, really helpful. Hmm. You know, I spend so much time talking to writers about stop trying to make a reputation for, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And that's really stopped me in my tracks to say, you know what? That's why we start.
Yeah, totally. It's kind of like, you know, have you ever been at I can't think of an example specifically, but the feeling of I want to help this person, but my motives aren't pure. Yeah. I would be helping this person to make myself feel better about myself. And then you drive on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an enemy victory. You know what I mean? I remember that happened with my neighbor. I knew that they had a lot going on and they had a funeral one weekend. And I noticed that he wasn't able to finish mowing this like acre sized part of his yard before they had company. And I was like, I should go mow his yard for him. And, that's kind of a gross thought because immediately I felt the pride before I'd even done it. I felt the pride of having mowed his yard for him. And I thought, oh yeah, that's going to be good, you know, cause he lends me his tractor sometimes. And this is a way of like evening the score and all of this stuff. And I almost didn't do it because I was so conflicted about my motivation. And then finally I was like, just mow the guy's yard, man. It's okay. And the entire time I was on the mower, I was so pleased with myself. I was just like, I am such a good guy. I'm doing this thing. And, you know, like the Lord's going to redeem all that stuff. But the point is doing something, you know?
Yeah.
And so if you're like, don't wait around for Pete's sake to make sure that you're not going to have any regrets. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, no, you're not going to be a perfect parent. That doesn't mean you don't have a baby.
Yeah. I always thought the most amazing thing Adam and Eve ever did was have a baby. After all that happened, you know what I'm saying? They completely broke the world.
Uh-huh.
And
Right, because they would have had a baby after all that.
Yeah, and they kicked. You know, there's this angel with a flaming sword, but there was also God saying your seed is going to bruise the serpent's head, and so they took God at his word and said, all right, I guess we'll have a family.
That's amazing. Yeah, I'd never thought about that before.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, so this is, I'm pretty sure this is going to be the first episode of the Habit Podcast after the new year.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what date that's going to be, but people are still thinking about making their plans for the new year. Sure. And I like to talk to people about, you know, maybe don't think in terms of resolution so much as habits.
Yeah.
A resolution feels like this is me doing something in my brain that's now going to change the course of my life.
Sure.
And whereas new habits, you know, go beyond your brain to your,
yep.
you know, to your body and to everything, you know, everything else. Talk to me about habits in your writing life.
Yeah. Well, I don't have good ones because mm-hmm. it goes in cycles.
You only write, like, you're not always writing songs. You're writing songs when you have an album coming
right.
up.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And so, and it's just a way of kind of staying sane. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not one of those people that just wakes up and goes, I can't wait to write a song today. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of other interesting things to be doing in the world. Mm-hmm. That a deadline is the thing that kind of reorders the mm-hmm. year. And I go, okay, so that means that, like, in January, I usually have a meeting with my manager, Christy, and we kind of map out the next year and a half or so. And mm-hmm. go, what things do we want to accomplish? And then everything works backwards from there. Mm-hmm. And so that's when the habits get in. But it speaks to what I was going to say, which is that I think accountability is the key. I was just talking to Andy Gullihorn about, he had a rotator cuff problem from mm. playing too much badminton. and he was going to the doctor and physical therapy and all this kind of stuff to get it done. And he told me that he was going to have to get surgery. And then he got a second opinion, and the second doctor was like, you don't need surgery, you just need to do your physical therapy. And Andy was like, I've been doing my physical therapy. He was like, well, you haven't been doing this and this and this. And so Andy said that after a few months of going to a physical therapist, and he was like, I was very committed because I wanted to play badminton again. So he was like, I was very committed to getting better. But once I had the meeting with this doctor, I had to admit to myself that I hadn't actually been doing as much work as I thought I'd been doing. Mm. So he said that what he did was he told Jill, his wife, to text him every day to make sure that he had done his physical therapy, and he got better. And it just made me think that accountability and community was the answer to the thing. Mm-hmm. So a resolution in my mind is like something you resolve to do within yourself. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think we need other people to help us develop habits. And, yeah. and I think that's church is a good example of that. Going to a church where people are going to miss you if you don't show up on a Sunday, and they're going to maybe text you later that day and say, hey, where were you? Yeah. Like, are you doing okay? Whatever. Yeah. It's hard to go to church. You know, some Sundays it's like, I don't know if I've got it in me. But then I think this is a habit that has been ingrained in me since I was a kid. And the week just won't feel right if I don't show up, you know? And so Dude Breakfast is that way for me. Like, mm-hmm. If I said to myself, I'm going to do a better job at seeing my friends, that ain't going to last. But if I talk to my friends and say, let's have breakfast every Wednesday morning at the Waffle House at 8 o'clock, mm-hmm. then now you've got something that's going to, form you, you know?
Yeah.
So I think whenever I, think about spiritual formation or habits that are going to shape me, it just can't be in my own mind. Like, I've got to do it in community or yeah. it won't work.
Yeah. Art nourishes community, community nourishes art.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, I always end these episodes with the question, who are the writers who make you want to write? So, who yeah. are the writers who make you want to write, Andrew?
Well, I think I said this last time I talked to you, but you are one of those people. Every time I read something you've written, I get excited about it because your voice is so uniquely Jonathan Rogers that it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the podcast yeah. that you just have to say it like you say it. And, yeah. and it is good. So truly,
well, thanks.
You are one of those people. I think, Mark Helprin is one.
Mm-hmm.
I just started reading another Mark Helprin book. His book, Winter's Tale, is just, I think, marvelous. Maybe magnificent. I started to say magnificent, but now I want to back it up a little bit. But it's one of those books that I could feel my brain crackling while I was reading it. And I didn't really know that language could do what it did.
I've never read Mark Helprin.
I think you would love it.
Halprin?
Helprin. Helprin. It's hard because his books are pretty big. They're like uh-huh. these big, long, like Tolstoy-sized books, uh-huh. but A Soldier of the Great War was the first one I read, and I loved it. But he's great, and Annie Dillard is one that, like, there are certain authors that when I see their books on the shelf, I'll just kind of pull it down and open to a random page and then mm-hmm. stand there for 5 minutes.
Yeah,
she's one that makes me want to write.
I feel like there's some way to make a chart of the writers who like Annie Dillard and the writers who, I mean, everybody admires Annie Dillard, and some people really enjoy reading her, and some people like, I'm impressed with this, but it's not my thing. I'm so impressed with her, yeah. but I don't voluntarily just pick it up and read.
Interesting.
It.
Interesting, yeah. No, I Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, like, I could open up to any page and kind of uh-huh. get lost for a few minutes. Mainly because it's like, as a songwriter, if you go see Phil Kagi, mm-hmm. you want to quit playing guitar forever, yeah. right? You just go, well, that's amazing. There's mm-hmm. a genius there that's crazy. But then there's another kind of songwriter. When I go see James Taylor, I think, oh, I could learn to play that guitar part.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I could sing Sweet Baby James around mm-hmm. a campfire. Mm-hmm. And so there are some writers that they're no less excellent in what they do, but right. there's something kind of attainable. Like mm-hmm. Most of us who write probably have a book that we read at some point and you thought, oh, I think I actually could do this. Maybe not yeah. as well, but
yeah.
enough to make you want to try.
And you don't remember what that book was for you, do you?
Well, for me, it was, from a musical standpoint, it was Mark Cohn
yeah.
and Toad the Wet Sprocket.
Mm-hmm.
Both of whom were baritones, Glenn Phillips is a baritone, so it was like in my range, I could actually uh-huh. sing the songs.
Yeah.
And then it was Rich Mullins, because mm-hmm. once again, he wasn't a great singer,
yeah.
and so there was something attainable about it that mm-hmm. made me want to try to do it. And then poetically speaking, there was something about the language that those guys used that was earthy, and at the same time, there was like this real craftsmanship to it that appealed to me.
You're saying Mark Cohn and Toad the Wet Sprocket mm-hmm.
and Rich Mullins and James Taylor and mm-hmm. all those guys. When I hear Paul Simon, I'm a little bit more mystified.
Yeah.
That's more like a peak that I know that I'd never be able to climb. Mm-hmm. And again, just to clarify, I'm not suggesting that I'm as good as any of these guys. I'm just saying they make you want to get busy.
Yeah.
It feels like, oh yeah, I could, you know, I may not be able to finish the race as fast as they did, but I could run that mm-hmm. marathon. You know, mm-hmm. it may take me 10 hours. Does that make yeah. sense?
Oh, absolutely.
So anyway, those guys are, and I think Annie Dillard and Mark Halperin are in that boat for me too. Again, not that I could do it, but that I want to try.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who else? Buechner was that way for me. Mm. Frederick Buechner. There was something yeah. about the rhythm of his sentences that was yeah. really appealing to me and mm-hmm. and musical.
Yeah.
That made me want to try it.
So, yeah.
Yeah, those are a few to get started.
Yeah, great. Well, Andrew, thank you. I always love when we get a little bit of time to talk.
Me too, man. It's good to talk to you.
We'll do it again soon.
The Rabbit Room has partnered with Lipscomb University to make this podcast possible. Lipscomb has graciously given us access to their recording studio in the Center for Entertainment and Arts building. We're so grateful for their sponsorship, their encouragement, and the good work they do in Nashville. Special shout out as well to Jess Ray for letting us use her song Too Good as part of this podcast. Visit jessraymusic.com to hear more of her beautiful songs.
The Habit membership is a library of resources for writers by me, Jonathan Rogers. More importantly, The Habit is a hub of community where like-minded writers gather to discuss their work and give each other a little more courage. Find out more at thehabit.co.
This podcast was produced by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. All our podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our members. To learn more about us, visit rabbitroom.com, and to become a member, rabbitroom.com/donate.